From the auditorium of the Annenberg School of Communications of the University of Pennsylvania, this is the annual A.V.B. Gehagen Memorial Lecture. The lecture will be delivered by Dr. Marshall McLuhan, a visitor from the University of Toronto, Canada. The title of the lecture is From Gutenberg to Batman. The first speaker is the Dean of the Annenberg School, Dr. George Gerbner.
Good evening. When television was still a novelty, an observer of the cultural scene named Marshall McLuhan clipped a news story from a paper which began like this. Chicago, April 21, 1950. Two condemned murderers saw themselves on television last night. The doomed men were filmed in death row yesterday afternoon. The film was then put on the 7 o'clock newsreel and viewed by the men on a set loaned them by the warden. Imagine, commented McLuhan in his book on The Mechanical Bride, what a thrill these men must have got from being on the inside of a big inside story. Ladies and gentlemen, by now the whole civilized world, if I may use that sloppy euphemism, wired together tightly enough for a closed circuit to snuff out all the lights, and living and writing and witnessing at the same time its own instant history, is sharing the thrill of being on the inside of a big inside story of its own, with Marshall McLuhan and others wondering what the verdict might be. And here we are in our own electronic microcosm, closed circuit, taking the signal to all parts of the building, to ponder with Professor McLuhan and to discuss the meaning and significance of the new symbolic environment whose understanding may, just may, hold a clue to our condition. It is appropriate that this occasion should be the annual Anthony V.B. Gehagen Lecture, established by friends and associates of the late Mr. Gehagen of Young and Rubicam, to memorialize his own creative contributions to the transformations of our time. It is equally appropriate that we should meet in a graduate school of communications dedicated to the understanding of the man-made transformation which now makes men to its own image. So let me welcome you all, invite you to share and participate in the discussion. Let me introduce your moderator, author, critic, director, producer, professor of communications, and human being extraordinary, Robert Louis Cheyenne.
Dean Gerbner, guests, members of the faculty and students. The other night, Marshall McLuhan was visible to all of us on a local television station, appearing in a dialogue with Eric Goldman on the program The Open Mind. Professor McLuhan said that you don't discover the rules of a football game until you get to the field. There is an analogy to this event in his remark. In McLuhan terms, this is an open field situation. We really will be discovering the rules of the game as we go along. But some of us are still print-oriented, straight-line perspective men, so let's anticipate the game we're going to play, lay down a few of the rules, and describe the players on the field. Marshall McLuhan, of course, is the star quarterback for the visitors. After he plays his game, the varsity opposition will descend on him. These are the members of our panel. Now, after they've had a go at the star quarterback, you, the audience, will have a turn to play in a question and answer period. Those in the auditorium may ask their questions directly of Mr. McLuhan and the members of the panel. There'll be microphones up and down the aisles. Those watching us on closed-circuit television are equally involved. They may, if they wish, get slips of paper from the ushers who are with them, write their questions, which will be passed into the auditorium at the time of the question and answer period. Some of you may like to prepare in advance. This is your cue outside. Now, immediately after Dr. McLuhan has finished his talk, we'll begin the panel discussion. So let's meet the members of the panel now. They are seated in the front row center. And after I introduce each one individually, I will ask him please to stand up so the audience can see him and acknowledge him with their applause. First, Mr. William Jovanovich, president of Harcourt Brace and World Incorporated, book publishers. Mr. Jovanovich is the author of the book Now Barabbas, and he sold, edited, and designed books himself. He describes himself as a sort of a sympathetic fellow traveler of Marshall McLuhan. He's been so stimulated by Mr. McLuhan's ideas that he's writing a book with him about the new uses of information in our society. Mr. Jovanovich is a man whose values and interests are deeply involved in the world of print, but he's willing to probe and explore with Professor McLuhan and to challenge him when necessary. He says he'll get his book with McLuhan written if they ever stop talking long enough. You could say of Mr. Jovanovich that he doesn't mind feeding the tactile hand that bites him. Mr. Jovanovich. Next, we have Dr. Del Himes, who is a professor of anthropology here at the University of Pennsylvania and author of a book, Language and Culture in Our Society. Dr. Himes is a member of several learned societies in the fields of anthropology, linguistics, and folklore. We've cast him this evening in the role of the fullback of the opposition. He's reviewed The Gutenberg Galaxy, one of McLuhan's books, and he said in his review that the book was, quote, stimulating, rich in pertinent materials and observations, and then he added that the book cannot be trusted as more than stimulation. The oversimplified view of types of society and character get facts wrong. It, the book, can no more stand against an adequate view of human history than any other single-minded exegesis known to us. Professor Del Himes. And in the corner beside Dr. Himes, or I should say at the next fluid point in our mosaic image, Mr. William Dozier, the man who gave us Batman on television. You know, it may be... Look at the gentleman sitting next to you. It may be you know who. It may be profoundly symbolic or a singularly useless fragment of information to note that at this very moment, before the eyes of 35 million hypnotized Americans across America, the Caped Crusader and Robin His Boy Wonder are busy wrapping up the case of the Riddler's false notion. Mr. Dozier, of course, represents the magic environment of television which looms so greatly in Dr. McLuhan's vision of communications. He's president of Greenway Productions on the 20th Century Fox slot. He created, or was responsible in creating, The Donna Reed Show, The Farmer's Daughter, Hazel, and Bewitched, plus a number of films. Now, I don't know what position he will take this evening. You know, events move with electric speed in Mr. Dozier's life. Not so long ago, he was sitting on a plane heading east from Hollywood, and there were piles of Batman comic books on his lap. ABC Television had asked him to do a pilot on the comic strip. And Mr. Dozier confesses that he hadn't looked at a comic book since he was 8 years old. An advertising agency executive passed down the center aisle of the plane, spotted Mr. Dozier and the comics on his lap, Zam, Powie, Biff, Kerhue, and he twitted him with, "Television scripts must be getting awfully dull to read these days." 2 months ago, Bill Dozier, I guess, hadn't heard about Marshall McLuhan. There's evidently a 525-line electronic curtain surrounding Hollywood to deflect print messages. But he's been studying him avidly since, in between getting out Batman episodes, doing the voice of the narrator on the Batman series, and preparing a new series for television on our old friend, the Green Hornet. And we'll find out shortly where Bill Dozier stands. Bill? Now then, I suppose for most of the people in tonight's auditorium, any introduction of mine for Marshall McLuhan would be camp. His friends say he is easily the most celebrated thinker of our time in the field of communications. He is the author, as most of you know, of three major works. They are The Mechanical Bride, published in 1951, The Gutenberg Galaxy in 1962, and most recently, Understanding Media. He is a Canadian who teaches at the University of Toronto, where he is the director of the Center for Culture and Technology to study the psychic and social consequences of technologies and media. Dr. McLuhan consults with corporations, intimidates whole industries, and has an engaging way of restructuring the universe of almost anybody who reads him or tries to engage him in a conversation. You know, for years, our neighbor nation to the north, Canada, has been appalled by the invasion of its borders by what it calls the tawdry American culture. In my considered opinion, Marshall McLuhan is Canada's revenge on the United States of America. You have only to open a copy of Lifetime, Newsweek, Vogue, or other indices of our psychic state to see how his ideas are infecting ours. To some people, though, Dr. McLuhan is serious business, a man who's trying to make us aware that communications technology is dangerously changing our psychic environment, and that if we are to survive, we must learn how to control that environment. Tonight, we want him to know that he's among friends. To our audiences, I'll say this. You are about to experience a happening. You may not know what has happened after the evening is finished. You may be confused, but you will surely know that something has happened, and you may judge it to be very interesting. As the evening's major probe into our new environment, its roots in Gutenberg and its antennae in Batman, I give you the greatest broken field runner of academia since Red Grange, the Galloping Ghost, Dr. Marshall McLuhan.
If that wasn't a paralyzing sort of pitch, I don't know. However, to use the handy phrase, that kind of making one welcome and feeling at home is enough to, the old saying, home is where you hang your head. Well, it's hanging. Ladies and gentlemen, my head is hanging. But I'll try to recover my poise, my pitch in a moment. In the meantime, greetings from the land of the dew line, the early warning system. And now my job is to blow both horns of my dilemma, as a friend says. As one foot across each side of the border, blowing both horns of his dilemma. This kind of opportunity is just altogether too big an opportunity, and I think one's bound to do it less than justice. But I'm delighted to be here. I've been here before. I enjoy this place. I'm very fond of it. And please understand that what I'm going to say in the next few minutes as preparatory to the return bout with the panel What I'm going to say is by way of just exploratory probing, I'm not trying to package up definitive opinions, which I'm expecting you to swallow at all. I'm tossing them out to you as an invitation to participate. And let me suggest as an opening pitch that we are seated here in a very delightful situation on the very verge of a very large changeover in our entertainment industry. It's like many large changes hidden till the last moment, but the American public is about to enter the entertainment industry as participant. That is, the audience is about to become workforce. I'll just list a few of the major flips that the whole establishment is in a posture to do in the next few months, as it were, and certainly a few years. And I would mention that as what probably the most spectacular flip that will occur in the next few, well, months, 2 or 3 years. And it has been held up by strange accidents, as, for example, the misunderstanding of the quiz shows. The quiz shows of lamentable fate were a time when the American public had a sense of involvement in the show, was participant in the show, and then suddenly they felt they'd been cheated and left out because of the rigging. Now, the possibility of the whole audience in prime time participating in the top-level solution of top technical problems is so obvious as to, again, it's rather breathtaking to think of why it hasn't been pursued. But it is conceivable in a very near future that the whole American public will be invited in prime time to participate in the solution of top problems in science. Robert Oppenheimer is fond of saying their kids playing here on the sidewalk could solve some of my toughest problems in physics because they have methods, modes of sensibility that I lost 40 years ago. Now, why not invite these hopscotchers and play kids into the inner sanctum of physics by briefing in prime time on top-level problems in the sciences? Because what 8 or 9 scientists might not be able to solve at any particular moment would not be too difficult for 10 or 30 or 40 million people to solve in a few seconds, if given the problems. Now, I'm simply going to do a little tour, a preview tour of operations before doing another return tour. And, yeah, apropos of Mr. Dozier's presence and Batman, I've thought of a phrase that might have occurred in the title of this little talk, and it was actually the phrase I used while writing the Gutenberg Galaxy. I called it Goot Gal, instead of my wife and others. We called it the Goot Gal, and it seems to go quite naturally with Batman. And the big flip over from Goot Gal to Batman is a flip from pics to icons, from pictures to icons. Now, to understand the change from the world of pictures to the world of icons is to understand a world of change from which there is gradation and chiaroscuro and continuity to a world in which everything is abrupt interface. The world of the icon is a world of abrupt interface. Those of you who have watched Dr. Zhivago as film will have noticed the strange soundtrack. I'm not especially aware that this particular type of soundtrack has been used widely, but in that film, if a train gets underway, it doesn't gradually reach a crescendo. There's just a sudden wham, bang, like the sounds in Batman. There is no gradation in the sound buildup. Everything is just sudden interface. The French have been trying to write novels this way. The Rob Grier type of novel and so on is a novel in which there are no characters in the ordinary sense. They're just the abrupt encounters, a la Batman, of cartoon icons. Now, the world of the icon is a world of abrupt interface, without gradations, no chiaroscuro. And this is a world that is happening on many fronts. And when you have these interfaces, you have happenings, you don't have a storyline. We'll come back to that in a moment. But the world of the interface is a world of happening because things, surfaces grind against each other and create new forms. But the world of the interface is the world of the happening and it's the world of the cartoon And TV had been protected from this interface by the movie industry for quite a long time and by the effects of the movie industry in TV. But the now TV is affecting the movie industry. Now, I'm just going to give you a few moments to move around in, familiarize yourself with some of the basic scenery of the Gutenberg galaxy, and then we'll move into the world of Batman. There's a book by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he observes that science is not discovery-oriented. It's his theme of the whole book. Science makes discoveries, but it's not especially keen about this. Scientists have, as he points out, through 2,500 years of Western history, tended to oppose all scientific discovery whenever it has been made. This is human. It isn't really scientific or unscientific. It's just human. People don't like anything new, anything that requires adjustment. There's a book by Owen Barfield called Saving the Appearances, in which he points out that one of the peculiarities of our Western world is that by means of alphabet, we have enabled ourselves to detach ourselves from the world. We, unlike all tribal societies, we are not involved. Tribal societies are involved. Participation mystique. The world of the mystical participation in the cosmos, in the universe, it goes with all pre-literate worlds. And in the literate world, you have for the first time in Greece and so on, since you have a habit of detachment, of non-involvement, of non-participation, which is a kind of unfriendly and uncooperative, uninvolving gesture toward the universe. And this has been the basis of all Western society. All Western society has grown on this wonderful power of Western man to refuse to be involved in the world he lives in. Detachment. Objectivity. And Barfield is ably seconded by Eric Havelock in his preface to Plato. Havelock does this wonderful study of how tribal man moved over into the Platonic world of the ideas and of detachment and classification. And Havelock owes a great deal to Harold Innes, a fellow Canadian, who wrote some quite fascinating pioneering work on the matter of the study of these forms, the life of forms, and their effect upon man's innards and outards. But the a man who has followed up this study in a very special way is Edward T. Hall. Edward T. Hall, in his book, The Silent Language, and now his book, the new book, The Hidden Dimension, studies on the one hand time, on the other hand space. And Hall, in his new book, for example, I'll just give you one little anecdote out of that book illustrating spatial form, and give it to you by way of relevance to our position tonight. He tells of how he was sitting in a hotel lobby in Chicago a few years ago, watching an elevator from which he expected to see a friend emerge shortly, when suddenly he became aware of a rather strange presence beside him. This personage kept coming very close and practically breathing down his neck and generally being obnoxious and offensive and troublesome and importunate, and he hadn't a clue as to who this person was. He said that suddenly this person was joined by several other people who, the moment they appeared, enabled Hall to heave a sigh of relief because he realized they were Arabs. And at this point, he begins his little exposition. He says, "You see, in the Arab world, any solitary person minding his own business is fair game. You shoot him down as best you can. Whereas," he says, "in our world, a solitary person minding his own business is inviolate. In the Arab world, such a person is fair game. You shoot him down. On the contrary, in the Arab world, any moving person is inviolate. And anybody who goes near a moving person or object is beneath contempt, is in fact a very dangerous and unpleasant person. Therefore, if you pass an Arab on a highway, you are doing something absolutely forbidden. He is moving, he is inviolate. And by the same token, on our continent, anybody who is minding his own business, staying put, is inviolate, and anybody who barges into him is being disagreeable and intolerable. Now, in the same way, you can see how anybody in our world who minds his own business, specializes in one subject, is inviolate. He's an expert. Anybody who crosses boundaries, keeps moving across boundaries and so on, he's contemptible. Shoot him down." Now, we're moving into a new world, electronic world, in which the moving person acquires the inviolate and character of an Arab in his culture. And whereas in our literate and visual culture, anybody who is moving across boundaries and refusing to occupy a fixed position is contemptible without any reason for respect or any kind of prestige. Now, we're changing that fast. We're moving, as it were, from the Arab into the, or from the American into the Arab orbit very rapidly at this present time. I'm going to mention a couple of other areas in which major flips are tending to build up very quickly right now. Apart from the audience as workforce, in which ends all rating systems, you see, there's no rating system necessary. When the audience becomes participant, there's no need any longer to rate programs. The audience makes its own show by being in the show. This is a happening. The a happening being a world in which everything happens at once, like a newspaper. Now, another area in which this big flip is due and is taking place somewhat now is the world of education, in which, after centuries of stress on instruction, we're moving into a world where education becomes a form of discovery instead of instruction. The whole educational establishment is sort of trending in that way, to switch from instruction to discovery as a way of learning. And when the whole environment, as we live in electronically, is a world of information, then the meaning of instruction inside the classroom and so on takes on a totally different character anyway. When the environment is not made of information, then the classroom has one meaning. When the environment itself becomes information, then instruction takes on a different character. Well, another kind of flip where one might not be quite ready for it. In the world of advertising, which is a world of information service, in the world of advertising, the tendency, a strong tendency, and long, much developed, is for the ad to take the place of the product and for people to derive their satisfactions from the ads rather than from the products. Now, this is not new. It's been going on for quite a long time, gradually building up, until the ad could easily substitute for product, where the information could become the real product and the hardware would become a mere footnote, an incident, a minor incident. Now, these flips are the kinds of things with which we live in constant association. Book that Mr. Yovanovitch and myself are working on in terms of the future of the book is similarly related to a major flip or reversal. The book has for centuries been a package, a very powerful and important commercial package, a repeatable, replaceable, repeatable commodity with a uniform pricing system and so on. The book, in fact, was the first uniform and priceable commodity in Western society. And with the coming of xerography, the reader becomes publisher and writer. The book becomes a service instead of a package. People can then phone up and tell some electric information service the sort of problem they're working on, the sort of book they need, and it will just be quickly produced as an information service and sent out on cards or sheets to the individual. The book, instead of being a uniformly repeatable package, can easily become, under electric information services, a tailor-made, custom-made, private service. That is where it's heading, and it means a tremendous revolution inside our whole economy. It's not only the book industry that's going to feel this revolution. But the book as service, instead of the book as package, is very much the sort of revolution we're living through on all fronts. And the commodity world itself, tending to become, on the whole, information instead of hardware, is part of this whole computer world. Now, in this new changeover to book or service under electronic conditions, you have, in a sense, reached the end of the storyline in a variety of the arts, as well as even in humor. And you know all these strange new Polish stories, elephant stories, and so on. There are no stories. There are jokes, but without stories. And Finnegan's Wake is built entirely of these jokes without storylines. The sort of, though he might have been more humble, there's no police like Holmes. You get quite a packet. It's quite a complicated package deal in a quip. And the strange changeover, you see how the youngsters in our world love these jokes without stories. The strange changeover from this type of the old-fashioned storyline story to the new instantaneous joke, instant humor, is worth watching because it contains the clues to a good deal that's going on in our world. We have come to the end not only of the storyline in the arts, in the novel, in the movie, and the clothesline is gone, and the stag line, and the party line, and the hem line, and the neck line, and the line as a form of organization of human experience is in trouble. But there are lots of old-fashioned jokes still hanging around, and I'll tell you one just to reorient ourselves. If from Canada, this is a typical Canadian joke at the present time because of the troubles with French Canada and English Canada. And the story concerns a mouse that was being pursued around by a cat. The mouse finally discovered a little hole in the floor and ducked down. All suddenly was very quiet, and the mouse began to get its hopes up when suddenly there was a sort of arf, arf, wow, wow sound, and the mouse figured the house dog came along and scared the cat off, so up popped the mouse, and the cat grabbed it. As the cat chewed it down, the cat said, "You know, it pays to be bilingual." illustrates also another strange aspect of much humor. A humor in many times, many places, often has this character of hidden grievance. And hence, so much of it tends to emerge from ethnic and minority groups. Because where the grievance is strong, the humor is strong, and the humor seems to have this character of a cultural protective layer. Now, the humor without stories, just the instantaneous humor, the Polish type I've mentioned before, perhaps, on other occasions, the Alexander Graham Kowalski, the first telephone pole. That was the first Polish joke I'd heard, and it's, I think, still the best one. There's no storyline in that type of humor, or that type. It's instantaneous. It shows everything at once. It's a happening. That is a happening as a joke. That is, everything happens at once. So that's what a word happening means. A happening is an all-at-once situation in which the actors and the audience are one group, and in which all the events that go on affect all the other events at the same time. Back in the 1920s, there used to be much concern about the meaning of meaning. Now, it's quite easy to define. The meaning of meaning is that it is a happening. You know the old expression, "What's the meaning of this?" And when you have occasion to utter that phrase, you mean, "What's going on here? What's happening?" The meaning of meaning is quite simply a happening. And it can't be verbalized, really. It's just an all-at-onceness that doesn't have any verbal form possible to it. A newspaper is a happening because of all the multitudes of little items in the newspaper, there's no connection between any of them. Take off the date line from any newspaper and you have a surrealist poem. Literally, that is, any newspaper minus date line equals surrealist poem. And that's a happening. That's what the happening people have discovered. Really, they have merely projected into the environment the form of newspaper, all at onceness. But if you try to tie together all the episodes in a newspaper, you merely start writing editorials, and everyone knows they are not happenings. But they are a fixed point of view. You zero in from a fixed position, and you get an editorial. The all at onceness of the newspaper is a telegraph form. It's a happening. The happening world of these new art forms is a world in which the audience joins the actors, whereas formerly they had been spectators. The audience in the world of the happening becomes participant totally. And this is happening to you people, and you will fortunately soon be participating in this show. And the idea, you see, in all the arts, in painting, in poetry, in drama, all the revolutions of the past few decades have been to get the audience into the action. The audience has moved steadily into the act. And this is one of the strange results of electronic circuitry in which you have everything going on at once, including no division between actors, audience, and authors and readers. Now, this, I might suggest, is also the meaning of the safety car. The safety car interests me very much, and any new form that pops up unexpectedly, I always spend a little time thinking about because I know it's got some important meanings. The safety car is a car in which, instead of just projecting an object into an environment, people begin to say, what does this do to the environment? Instead of just allowing the car to be an object in an environment, they say, how does this affect the human environment? And the safety car, therefore, is somewhat like the safety pin. You fold it back into itself and clasp it. So the design of the safety car will include you. The pedestrian, the audience, will be included in the design of the car. Now, increasingly, I think you'll find that's the way poetry is made and painting is made and architecture is made. The whole public is involved in the design itself. And this calls for a considerable amount of change of structure and style. Instead of just sending out the car or sending out the message into the public, you build the public in from the beginning. The design of the product includes the public and the effects that the product is supposed to have on the public. So this is somewhat related to advertisements. Ads now include the product and tell you how the product affects you. Picasso, 50 years ago, was painting pictures, for example, man sitting in chair. There was no man, there was no chair. It was just how did it feel to be sitting in a chair? The effect of sitting in a chair was what he painted, not the chair or the man. And that's the way the ads are now being made. They include both the viewer and the product in a single effect, which is a new type of art form. Now, the safety car is somewhat in that way related to In Cold Blood. In Cold Blood, as you know, some of the reviewers have been puzzled. They figure that the whodunit means probably Capote did it. Because Kenneth Tynan, you see, his figures that the murderer was the author. Alternatively, the reader. It's one of the two. And now, remember when King Oedipus set out to discover who done it? Some evil had been done in his kingdom, and he was determined to find out who done it, and he found out soon enough he had done it. In any highly involved, intricate feedback network, it is impossible to say he done it. I saw him. Get him. In an electric society where everybody affects everybody at the same moment, it is impossible any longer to say he done it. It's just as realistic to say, I did it. And so, again, at instant speeds of involvement of people in people, not only is there no possibility of assigning guilt for the things that people formerly had legalistically assigned guilt, there is also the difficulty of even knowing who we are. That is, personal identity becomes a real problem. The big headache of our time, existentially and so on, is who am I? How do you know who you really are? Well, the existentialists are simply responding to electric circuitry. After centuries of wheel and slow movement, if you move suddenly into the dimension of instant electric circuits, the problem of who I am or who we are becomes a serious one. Because identity had for centuries been assigned to the matter of classification. I am a Hungarian, I am a dentist, I have 6 kids. That was identity. 50 years ago, people could be sure of who they were that way. Today, that no longer serves as human identity. And, for example, among our own children today, they refuse to accept jobs as a form of identity or mark of significance. They want roles instead. The job was a highly classified, specialized activity. Today, the role is returning. The man in the role, a man, say a top executive, doesn't have a job. He has 50 jobs, 60 jobs. That's a role. A mother doesn't have a job. She has 60 jobs. That's a role. Now, in the electric age, all forms of human activity become associated, closely interwoven again. Fragmentation, specialism disappears with circuitry, and roles return. Roles equal depth, equal involvement, equals commitment, equals dedication. And the old job represented simply fragmented classification, detachment, non-involvement. Under conditions of electronic instant circuitry, you cannot have jobs. It has nothing to do with the computer as such. It's simply the fact that the world of the job was a world in which specialism and fragmentation had been pushed to a very high level, and it had many advantages. In the Orient, for example, they are acquiring those very techniques today, even as we are acquiring the opposite techniques. I'll come back to that. But the when you live in an electric all-at-once environment, you create an overload of information in the environment, which drives everybody to various strategies for coping with information overload. The basic strategy for coping with information overload is myth, so that our youngsters today have automatically rediscovered the meaning of myth. They live mythically. They're still being educated and taught non-mythically, but they live mythically. They experience a huge disproportion or discontinuity between living integral, electrical, mythical lives and being pushed into old situations of specialized fragmentation and compartmentalization and classification. As you push the young out of their electronic environment into the educational establishment, they experience this strange dichotomy, this strange split, which creates what Paul Goodman calls growing up absurd. I had a chat with him the other day, and he was not too happy about having it explained to him. he preferred the myth to the explanation. But a myth is a happening. A myth is a form of all-at-onceness, an instantaneous grasp of a complex situation. That's myth. Myth is instant. It takes in huge and complex factors in one image, as it were. Now, under conditions of literacy, under conditions of analysis and objectivity, myth explodes into bits. Today, under conditions of electric circuitry, myth is once more integral, effective, operative. And so in our information overload environment, our young people are living mythically without any warning. Nobody's told them. And nobody's explained why it should happen to them. I'm thinking of Bonanza, whose producer, like the producer of Batman, I recently met. Bonanza is seen weekly by 350 million people in 62 countries. Now, it is an image of 19th century myth. It's a 19th century myth or form being shown to 20th century suburban man. 20th century suburban man regards that myth as a kind of image of his own life. He doesn't think of it as 19th century. He thinks of it as now. I wonder what happens in Indonesia or India when they watch Bonanza. To them, they never had a 19th century, somewhat like the West Coast. There never was a 19th century on the West Coast. They leapfrog right out of the 18th into the 20th. And most of the countries of the world have never had a 19th century or any other until the 20th. And so when they watch Bonanza, it must appear to many of them as an image of the future, sort of a science fiction image of what they could become in due time. My friend told me, the producer of Bonanza told me, he said, you know, just the other day in Nairobi, in Africa, a little boy was found in the streets, and when questioned where he'd come from and so on, he said he had come to Nairobi to meet Mr. Cartwright. And they said, why Mr. Cartwright? Oh, he said, I've seen him, and I know he can help me. And Mr. Dortort thought this was a very touching testimony to his program, which I think it is, too. But because, after all, Bonanza is not a depraved or unfortunate type of entertainment. It's, however, 19th century and mythical in its orientation. It's a compassionate and noble program. But the I'm not against these things. The this little boy must be very much like millions of other people all over these 62 countries who feel that Mr. Cartwright could be a big help in the kind of community he lives in. But to most of these countries, the Bonanza show would look like a great big science fiction image of what we might become someday. And it has a totally different meaning for us. It raises this strange question that has been interesting me a great deal lately, the inability to perceive environment and the tremendous power of any new environment to create a bright and clear image of the old one. The latest suburban world sees itself in terms of the previous world, Bonanza. It doesn't see the 20th century. It doesn't see its present environment. It sees the old environment. And this rearview image, this rearview mirror image of the world, is a characteristic, I think, of all cultures when confronted by new technologies. The moment any new form strikes, the old form surges up as a bright and clear image to preoccupy all attention. You know the old notion that we learn by moving from the familiar to the unfamiliar. It would seem to be equally true that when confronted with the unfamiliar, we translate it at once back into the familiar, and therefore are always cut off from looking at anything new. There seems to be some deep-rooted human instinct which says, never look at the Gorgon. Always borrow the mirror of Perseus before you dare to look at the Gorgon. Well, now, in our very rapidly changing environment, where one technology succeeds another every few months almost, and I would suggest, by the way, that color TV is a new technology, a new medium, not just the adding of color to the old one. We'll come back to that, maybe. But the when confronted with a new technology, the instinct is to revive an old one, just like the silence on TV and the comic book on color TV.
Dr. Himes?
I wanted to go back to a point that Dr. McLuhan raised about the anthropological approach, rather holistic. And if I were looking at our society that way, the trouble I would have with some of your theses is this, that perhaps just to dramatize the point, you seize upon the newest thing as the most salient aspect of the technology or environment and characterize what is happening in terms of it. But if I look around me, and I admit to living in perhaps an isolated part of the society, the university, I don't see just one medium, TV. I see sometimes TV, sometimes radio, sometimes book. So what you actually have is a sort of a mix.
And
this is what would interest me to find out about our society. Yeah, what's the nature of this mix for different parts of society?
Professor Hunt, we've just been discussing the effect of TV on movie and on book and on other forms. Now, the same way, then there's a wonderful new book that was released a few weeks ago from MIT Press called The Railroad and the Space Program, which studied the effect of the railroad on North American life all through the 19th century. One of the first effects the railroad had was to invent the myth of the innocent past, the Jeffersonian world. Railroad, as it mechanized the whole environment, created the image of a green pastoral world of innocence. And exactly in this nostalgic pattern that you get with Batman, if you like. But the point I was going to bring up about the railroad, it created a total new urban and social and family world, a new way of work, a new way of management, while creating attention only for this innocent image of a pastoral world earlier.
Certainly they correlated, but some people have argued that there were some parts of the society which had a certain interest in cultivating those images, such as rural legislators.
The effect of railroad on legislation and on judiciary and so on is fantastic. But you think that you can't really study the action of forms like that, that the life of forms is beyond our power of observation. You see, the railroad as a form affected all other forms. It didn't just affect the immediate form of, say, railway stations or something like that. It affected family life.
Sure.
It affected the dreams, the images of people. Now, this when it was new, it was totally unobserved. It is now being studied. 100 years later, when the railway is obsolescent, it is now being studied as an art form. Now, I say, why not study these forms while they're still delivering their maximal impact, while they're still making their maximal change, and when we can still do something?
Okay, I would agree, but then I would have difficulty then if one says TV is doing this to us. Well, I say I'm not exposed only to TV. I also listen to radio. I also this, that, and the other.
So Dr. McLuhan says study them all.
Absolutely.
All forms of electronic technology. All right. We've been building up ahead of steam in our audience here. They're part of this mosaic field, and let's let them into the action. Do we have our microphones on the aisles? Now, I will identify a speaker or a questioner. When I do, please stand and wait until the nearest microphone gets to you, and then go ahead. And I'll try to identify two people in advance so the mic can get to you. Now, let's have the show of hands, please. Are there any in this section? All right, we'll start with the gentleman in the... But that's all right. We'll start with the gentleman in the sweater, Giles, and then we'll go to, is it a lady? I can't see. In the fourth row. Okay, you will be next. Will you start, please? Giles?
Somebody's chewing you.
Giles? No, this mic will pick you up.
Go over there, please, Sue. Right. Go ahead.
Dr. McLuhan, you've just spoken about railroads and the way they infected our environment and have related to the nostalgia for a previous environment. I think Blake wrote Jerusalem in 1805 and that the first railway in England was founded in 1832.
Let's notice that the industrial environment had formed long before Blake's poem was written, that England was already becoming a world of dark satanic mills long before that. But the railroad came a little later, but factories had begun to desecrate the English scene by 1730.
I believe the recent studies on the Industrial Revolution tend to point out that, in fact, it didn't really begin until 1815, and that if you look at figures of steel production in England, for instance, you'll find that they're totally insignificant.
I understand exactly what you meant. Blake began to respond to these environments while they were relatively new. I think you'll find, for example, that Seurat was painting television in 1880, long before any engineer dreamed of it. Now, I mean, what is now going on among artists is already an indication of huge social changes ahead. The artist is always 50 years at least ahead of any engineer or technician. Now, give Blake, allow him 50 years if you like. But for heaven's sake, he had prophetic and prescient power. And that's the value of the artist. He, as a navigational aid, he gives you some time to get your breath. And or are you simply thinking the artist tracking along, matching, corresponding exactly to the society he lives in?
Let's have a very brief answer, so then we
can... Dr. Delhaus, I'm just a little worried about the causality in the mosaic we've been...
Well, that's what I say. Your idea of causality is matching.
Yeah.
It's not a life of forms.
But I find it kind of easier to understand.
Yes, because it's the old-fashioned form, yes. I know.
Thank you very much. The lady here, please. Sue, would you rise, please? It's amazing. I saw...
Ronnie Reagan.
I know that guy. He's from Cambridge. A history graduate from Cambridge University.
Exactly the same thing.
No. Shame on him.
There were mills.
I apologize. That's obviously the effect of the new environment. Go ahead.
Dr. McLuhan,
yes, except it could occupy a good many days of careful discussion. I was talking at supper tonight with Professor Johansson. Johansson?
Yes,
and about this very problem. And he pointed out that the vertical plane, which was an indispensable modality of visual space, the reason that I didn't say true space at all. I simply said pictorial space. Reason for the square or the enclosure as constituting an architectural revolution is a complicated one. And the Greeks never had it. The Egyptians never had it. The Romans were the first to get this pictorial space historically because they were the first to learn how to enclose these planes. But, as I say, this is a technical matter, and there's no use just pretending to skate over it in a few seconds here. But the vertical plane, said Professor Johansson, is something that is now becoming completely discontinuous and disoriented in our world. So discuss it with him sometime he's here. And the vertical plane in architecture is undergoing just as many abrupt changes as the storyline in poetry, and it is becoming a world of happenings, literally. What is going on architecturally in the vertical plane areas of texture is very much like the world of the happening.
Now, may we identify a questioner to come up next here? I don't want to make the same mistake, so I'll say the individual on the aisle who has his hand up. And will you wait just a moment, please, because I want to ask a question on behalf of the audience outside the auditorium. It seems to have some instant interest. Dr. McLuhan, how do you see God in this electric circuit?
Well, I was quite interested in the phrase, God is dead. If you, again, using the simple formula of the back rearview mirror, obviously the Newtonian God
The God who made a clock-like universe and wound it up and started going, he withdrew, he left, he died a long time ago. That is the God that is dead. That is the only one that is being observed. The Newtonian universe, the God who manufactured that universe, is dead. That's what Nietzsche meant. And he wasn't looking at his time or his world. He was looking back at the old world. That God is dead, indeed. So the anybody who's looking around for a simulated icon of the deity in Newtonian or even Einsteinian guise might well be disappointed. But I merely mention that in passing, that the phrase God is dead applies aptly, correctly, validly to the Newtonian universe. That also is dead. The ground rules of that universe on which so much of our Western world is built have dissolved. Those ground plans have dissolved.
Very good. The gentleman in the middle, would you please rise?
Dr. McLuhan, could you explain briefly in depth rather than breadth your statements on the mythical existence of today's younger people?
Oh, a myth means putting on the audience, putting on one's environment. The Beatles do this. Our youngsters respond to the Beatles because here are a group of people who have suddenly been able to put on their audience and put on the English language with musical effects. And this putting on of a whole vesture, of a whole time, of a zeit, of a world, that is mythical. The kids are diving into these costumes in the eagerness to find a formula for putting on the universe, participation mystique. They're not looking for detached jobs or detached patterns of relating themselves to the world a la 19th century. They're looking for this kind of mystical participation in the whole show. So putting on one's time, one's whole contemporary world, that is a mythic form. Myth is a world of happening of all-at-onceness. By definition, myth equals all-at-onceness. It's a simultaneous event. And the word myth in Greek means word.
Thank you. Jim, our mic is out on this side, so would you please come down and get set for a question on this side from the gentleman in the third row in the blue suit. Meanwhile, I will convey another question from the outside viewers, which has some interest. I think this is addressed to both Professor McLuhan and Bill Dozier. Is there any connection in your minds between Batman and Dracula? And if so, why has antagonist become protagonist? Dr. McLuhan?
Well, Mr. Dozier has some thoughts about that. I could talk about it. I'm not sure that I... Again, wouldn't you say, Mr. Dozier, the search for bogeys? The moment your pet values and pet world becomes threatened, upset, you start looking around for scapegoats, naturally.
Well, Dracula was a villain, and Batman, in most homes, is a hero.
Which homes is he not a hero?
In those who don't want their children to watch the show. And there are many of those. Otherwise, we'd have a higher rating, even. But I don't think you... Dracula was a horror concept, ghoulish, and he was a villain. The villains in Batman are gay fellows. They're more interested. I don't use the word advisedly. Their chief preoccupation in life is the joust with Batman and Robin, the game, the one-upsmanship, not the per se villainy in which they're engaged. I don't really see any comparison between, or any basis for comparison between Dracula and Batman.
Marshall?
Well, the Joker has a certain Dracula-like malignant qualities, wouldn't you say? That
if you mean he's growing on the audience, yes.
No. You mean, are you reporting that he's becoming more popular?
Yes, that's what I meant.
I didn't know.
Question here.
Dr. McLuhan, you've alluded several times to the effect that television has had on movies. In your book, you refer to movies as hot and TV as cool. Since movies are a large part of television, what, quote-unquote, happens when you show movies over television?
Well, it's you have two media simultaneously, which happens a great deal of time. When you're in the written word, you have speech in a visual form. On the telephone, you have two media going simultaneously. This is normal. You seldom have one medium all by itself or one sense operating all by itself. You never see anything without feeling, touching, moving. You never use any sense without using all the senses. In the same way, in the media world, no medium ever gets used in isolation. It's always used in connection with other media. And so this hybridizing, this orchestrating of various mediums is normal. But the effect of TV on movie has been to cool off movie. The hot part of the movie was the old storyline, which has been stripped off by TV.
There's a simpler answer, and that is that when movies are run on television, you blow both hot and cold at the same time. And next year, as you know, there'll be 10 hours of prime time per week devoted to feature pictures.
Bill, in last night's Batman, you had an inset in which they were watching a film screen in the action. Do you remember the screen?
Yeah, I remember.
And some student who was watching it commented on, that's a hot scene inside a cool context. Would you agree, Professor McLaurin?
Well, I hadn't seen that particular show, but it sounds as if that's exactly what happened. How in shooting it, what did you have in mind, Mr. Dozer?
It was a simple device where the Riddler was making a silent movie, an old-fashioned silent movie.
What sort of effect were you aiming at there?
We were aiming at complete nostalgia there. We were going back to the Chaplin period and the Keystone Cops, which is the forerunner of Batman in all comic books.
Uh-huh. Let's get another question from someone in this side, on this side, who hasn't asked yet. Jonathan Sanger, I think. Don't ask it now, because I want to convey another question from our audience, which says, Dr. McLuhan, I've often watched TV with a picture tube off. I found that TV is still largely an audio medium, because it is run by visually incompetent radio people. Have you any comment on the video part of television?
Well, it would take a week. But I have spent much more than that discussing this problem. But you see, in TV, you are not the camera eye looking out at a world. You are the screen. You receive the images. They are projected down that tube at you. You receive those forms. They wrap around you. You are the vanishing point while watching TV, and this creates a sort of inwardness, a kind of reverse perspective, which I personally think has much in common with Oriental art, and I think of TV as having a profound orientalizing effect on our Western world. It turns us inward, meditatively, seriously. The TV generation is a very grim bunch, and very serious. I've got six of them. I mean, I have six children. And they're much more serious than children would seem to have been during a previous period of growth, when they were more frivolous, more foolish, more whimsical. I think the children today are earnest, dedicated.
I don't see how you can say that, if I may interrupt. It depends a hell of a lot on who you are. For example, a lot of housewives leave the TV set running while they do their housework. They aren't being caught up. And there's evidence from New York kids, Bill Labov's work at Columbia in the sociolinguistics, that these kids, they're telling personal narratives, they have point and direction, they're involved in them. When they retell what they put on TV, that's sort of a pointless, rambling attempt to recapitulate just exactly some sort of sequence of events without personal involvement. I just don't think you can say that every kid who watches TV is involved in that way.
I simply said that we're living in a new generation of people who tend to be very much more depth-oriented than people were 40 years ago.
Well, how do they know if you retell a narrative you're not involved? Just what kind of sociological techniques are used to determine this? That sounds to me mad.
Well, it's not mad. In fact, if you were you're in New York, aren't you?
Yes, I'm.
You ought to call up the Columbian linguistics.
Well, no, you tell me. What is it in retelling narratives how do they know you're not involved?
If you try to analyze the story, you can see that when they're telling material from their own personal lives, there will be some point of personal reference. And it's too complicated, but there's a method for pointing out where this comes in and how it's handled. And you contrast this with narratives when they're telling you something they saw on TV or often, like Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is a very favorite favorite show, completely lacks certain kinds of materials which are present in their own.
When TV was new 15 years ago, librarians reported quite early on there'd been a great falling off of interest in narratives and fiction, and a great rise of interest in fact books, thing books, just plain data. And this has grown, I think, in all levels of entertainment.
There's a question here from Jonathan.
Dr. McLuhan, you've mentioned several media undergoing changes, and I've noticed that theater has also undergone tremendous changes in recent years, and concepts such as Artaud's concept of total theater involve the elimination of storyline, actually, and a play such as Murat Saad, which the storyline is not the important thing, and the important thing is the audience involvement, the involvement of everyone in the action, and would you call this, would this go along with your theory of the happening, this type of thing?
Yes, and Bertolt Brecht long ago deliberately used comic strips and tableaus from popular entertainment as a way of getting the audience involved in his theater. If you want to get audience involvement, you use the forms that they were brought up on in popular entertainment. This is exactly what Mr. Dossier was saying a moment ago, that their brief scene of Keystone movie-like was a nostalgic one for involvement. And I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm not saying anything about it, except I'm very interested in why these things happen and how they happen and what they do when they happen. I've perhaps trained myself deliberately to avoid all value judgments in pursuing these elements and these components. So I'm not being cold-blooded so much as just clinical.
One more question from this side. Let's identify the speaker first. Is there a hand up? That gentleman in the center. But let me first give a question from our viewers outside. You say meaning, Dr. McLuhan, is a happening, a connection of instantaneous non-sequences or sequiturs. But does not meaning involve memory?
I think so. And hence retrieval, recall, and that is part of that. One of the most profound happenings that is normal to every moment of waking life is memory, is precisely the interplay of previous events as we retrieve them. Retrieval is one of the most creative things we do by moment, as we recall any situation, any previous experience, we pattern it in a new form of happening, revealing all sorts of new aspects of it all the time. The unconscious presumably does this during our sleep in an even richer way than we do in consciousness. So it is a happening, it is something going on, active changing of components and forms by memory, by retrieval. I would say memory was itself one of the most profound types of happenings.
Question, please.
I'm unfortunately an electrical engineer. Whose electrons have been bandied around tonight.
Repeat that last statement?
I say, whose electrons have been bandied around this evening so much? I strike back. I'm intrigued with the dynamics of this sort of conservation of the norm. Something happens, man reacts. Now, naturally, he will react to his reacting. So in the sense of, I have a two-part question. Do you think he reacts to the reacting? In other words, he goes into oscillation, as it were, and maybe a deviant cannot take the oscillation and blows up. And the other thing, what goes on between the time he receives the stimulation and he's going back? Isn't this when he's really thinking?
This strange habit of the old formula about we learn by going from the familiar to the unfamiliar would seem to have an oscillatory effect equal and opposite, that we tackle the new by going back to the old and translating as much as possible all new experience into something we already know. This is the mark of the conservative mind at all times, is to pretend that whatever is new around us is really the same old stuff, slightly dulled up. And by this token, it becomes harmless. We can live with it. But, yes, I would say that the response to our own responses is like participating in our own audience participation. It creates all sorts of new kinds of experience for us. And this I would just simply have to say yes to, because it's enormously complicated when you think of the environment we live in and the amount of oscillation that is going on.
Isn't oscillation really thinking?
the mind may have to dramatize its movements that way in order to be in action. Yes, thinking is a form of action. Consciousness is a form of action. So thinking must have something in common with action. I should think of thinking itself as one of the most powerful acts capable of man is capable of. Yes, but I'm sure that this is also related to your little particles. Because the thinking is done by a bouncing around of multitudes of those.
Let's suspend this because we're running close to our closing time, and I'd like to get one more question from the outside audience and then some final commentary from our panel. Dr. McLuhan, would you advocate a great and accelerated program of investigation either to validate or disprove the theories which you present? If yes, do you believe that man could do very much about controlling, for his advantage, the transition you forecast?
Well, it's a rather large order, isn't it? But the answer is, again, as far as I'm concerned, emphatically yes. For example, in our schools, we teach only one medium. We educate awareness in the printed form, and we live with many forms in which no literacy is thought important, no training of perception thought to merit any effort on our part. I think this is pretty well indicated. I'm not suggesting we should use these forms in school. I'm not a person in favor of TV in the classroom. TV is doing far more outside the classroom than it could ever do inside. But I'm interested in training perception on all these forms and understanding of all these forms in class time, in prime time. And I'm sure that it's has begun to happen anyway, but I'm sure that it's mandatory that our educational establishment must simply take cognizance of the fact that we have now multitudes of environments created by things besides the printed word. I'd like to hear Mr. Jovanovich's observation, since he's very much involved in this world of providing the traditional print environment for us all.
Mr. Jovanovich, will you give us your reaction to that?
Well, I think we're all aware that there's a great deal of interest in the effect of electronics on education and whether, in fact, machines, and I'm not speaking about teaching machines a la Skinner, I'm talking about computer input-output systems, televised systems, printout systems, will, in fact, change the content of the grammar, secondary school, and college school, college teaching. There's no question in my mind but what it will. Now, it seems to me to get back to my original statement about humanism. I don't think you should fear this. I don't think anyone should fear this. Technology succeeds fundamentally, I think, when it does fulfill some human need and satisfy some human value. And in education, I don't expect books to disappear. I don't expect print technology to disappear. I expect other media to come into play, and there'll be an orchestration, as to use Marshall McLuhan's word, of these media. And I don't think old values disappear necessarily under new direction. And in the world of education, the question is not whether or not engineers will succeed authors as the instructors of mankind, because I don't think this is a value that will apply to this situation.
Thank you. Dr. Himes, would you have some final commentary you'd make?
Oh, I didn't know we were at that point. Nothing particular.
All right, Bill?
I would just like to say a couple of words about the totality of television. I'm not one who believes that television in total is a big success, as you know. I have gone on record very recently and been quoted, as a matter of fact, in a magazine which must be revered locally, certainly, TV Guide, to the effect that television is marching steadily toward total stagnation. I really believe that. I've been asked if I think Batman has started a trend, and I've said I hope not. I think rather it has, I hope, stopped a trend towards stagnation. If it has demonstrated only one thing, and that is that you can do something different and a little differently and make it succeed, then it has been a success, because it may inspire others in other areas, I hope, to try to do something different in television. Television suffers from being primarily a merchandising medium, not primarily an entertainment medium, unlike the theater, unlike motion pictures. And as long as it is that, and it will always be that, as long as there is a three-network complex, or four networks even, as long as it is that, circulation and accumulation of the mass audience is what is going to dictate. Therefore, programs are going to be selected that will do that and that will help sell merchandise. I listened to the head of a large advertising agency make a speech the other day in which he said, we select our programs to enhance the commercials. Now that, I think, is an appalling admission. And yet, that is the nature of the business, and I don't defend it totally. I don't even defend part of it.
Well, I'd like to thank the viewers outside for sending in the questions and the audience here for contributing to our involvement, our panel guests, and especially our distinguished speaker tonight who has given us something happening. Thank you all very much.
Oh, I see. It's up there. It used to be here.
Right.
New tech.